Hello, I'm Michael Serapio, and this is the Primetime Politics Podcast.
Tonight on Primetime Politics, tackling foreign interference.
And this new context calls for CSIS to be more agile in how it can conduct its investigations.
The Liberals release a long-awaited legislative package. How well does it address concerns of foreign meddling in Canadian affairs? We will speak with the former head of CSIS, Ward Alcock. Also, India is accusing Canada of letting criminals into this country and says Canada is the biggest problem for New Delhi. Coming up, BC Premier Ujjal Dosanjh about the tough talk from India and what Canadian politicians need to take from it. And the Conservative leader says he will not meet with lobby groups, including the Canadian Federation of Independent Business. We'll get reaction from the CFIB. This is Primetime Politics. Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Serapio. The Liberal government introduced its long-awaited foreign interference legislation today. The Public Safety Minister, Dominic LeBlanc, including a number of new measures, among them a foreign agents registry.
Under this registry, all individuals or entities who enter an arrangement with a foreign government or entity and who undertake activities to influence a government or the political process in Canada would be required to publicly register these activities.
Well, with his reaction to the legislative package introduced today by the Public Safety Minister, we're now joined by Ward Alcock. For 10 years, beginning in 1994, Mr. Alcock served as CSIS Director. Mr. Alcock, thank you for joining the program.
A pleasure.
So a lot to dig into with this legislative package, but I want to begin with the Foreign Agents Registry, because it's been talked about for some time. It is a part of this legislation. How important is that piece in terms of fighting foreign interference?
I think it's probably better characterized as a useful piece to fight foreign interference. The reality is that foreign interference registry is not a silver bullet. It won't entirely solve the problems. But what it will do, it will, on one hand, it will identify for Canadians those people who, in fact, are working or being paid by a foreign government to represent that government. And up until now, in some cases, we've not necessarily known whether somebody was getting paid or being remunerated or receiving some reward or whatever for doing so. That is a positive thing. I think the other thing it would do is it would create an offense. If you haven't registered and it turns out later that you should have registered, and which would allow you to be prosecuted for something that had happened in the past. And up until now, that might not have been the case. So it's a useful tool for law enforcement in dealing with some kinds of foreign interference.
Now, Canada would not be the only country pursuing this kind of registry. I'm wondering from what you have been briefed on, what you've read, whether or not it's actually been proven effective in other jurisdictions.
Well, I think the Americans have long had one, probably longer than anybody else. And there's a recent example of them using it in the case of Chinese officials who were seeking to carry out activities in the United States, and they moved to prosecution against those individuals. The Australians have also done something similar. I think the British have either done it or are in the process of putting something together. I think the New Zealanders have something as well, but certainly the Australians were the other major country, major partner of ours, if you will, create a piece of legislation in this area.
Mm-hmm. Now, under this legislation, beyond the Foreign Agents Registry, CSIS will also be given the authority to provide information to non-federal partners. I'm wondering, from your experience, why would that be important? Would that not open up intelligence to abuse?
Yeah, I think that was, my assumption was that the legislation would provide for something like that. In some respects, it was an advantage not having the authority to do that prior to this change in the legislation. CSIS could really only provide advice to the federal government. It was up to the federal government to to decide on whether somebody should or shouldn't be informed, or to what extent somebody should or shouldn't be informed. It does put a lot of responsibility on the service, which I assume it will exercise as carefully as it can, because it's not going to want to damage its intelligence capacity by providing information to somebody who then releases it to the public or doesn't look after it appropriately. And in some cases, frankly, whether it really is necessary to tell somebody that about the fact that they may or may not be being targeted by a foreign country is not entirely clear to me that that's an essential requirement. I think if there is information that there is a specific threat to an individual, that's clearly something where it's much easier to make a decision about trying to get some sort of information to that individual, all the way up to providing some protection from presumably the RCMP or some other police force. But if there isn't that kind of threat, then there's a serious question in my mind how far you go. I think there was a lot of pressure around the what was alleged to be targeting of, say, Michael Chong. Whether Mr. Chong actually really needs to know that the Chinese are trying to find out information about him, I'm not sure that that's essential. In my view, it's not particularly essential. I'm sure he regards it as essential, and others may regard it as essential. Clearly, the government has decided it's going to move in that direction or allow the service to move in that direction. But it isn't clear to me that it is necessarily essential for an individual to know such a low-level targeting as in the case of Mr. Chong.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, this legislative package, it was just introduced today, so we're going to see the political debate around it in the coming days. But given that this is just the start of the process, I'm wondering, based on your initial reading, are you encouraged by what's been introduced here by the government?
I think, as I said, it is a useful piece of legislation. Some of the other bits of legislation are much more housekeeping, and it's a bit odd to put some of them in into a bill in a minority situation. But I guess the government has decided that it's going to go with a package of all things at the same time, of similar things at the same time. They will clear up some problems in the CSIS Act that have been countered in the CSIS Act or in the findings of the federal court in particular. So it's a useful piece of legislation. I have always thought that I have thought for a long time that a foreign registry would be useful. I think the one worry I do have is that I think there are a lot of people who believe that. Who think that it is a silver bullet, and it is not, in fact, a silver bullet. It will help, but it will not ensure that foreign interference does not occur in Canada. It will perhaps make it clearer and make it easier to deal with interference in the political process itself, but foreign interference is a much bigger issue than just simply the interference in the political process.
Well, as you say, the debate just beginning. Ward Alcock, I really appreciate the insight tonight. Thank you for this.
A pleasure.
India's foreign minister is accusing Canada of welcoming criminals into this country. He made the comments when asked for his reaction to the arrest of three Indian nationals late last week. All three men are charged in the death of Hardeep Singh Najjar, a Canadian citizen and well-known Sikh activist who was shot dead last June outside a Gurdwara in Surrey, British Columbia. Well, for his thoughts on the comments that we're hearing from the Indian foreign minister, we're now joined by the former BC Premier Ujjal Dosanjh. Mr. Dosanjh, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So India, as you know, takes great issue with Canada right now. And as we said, the foreign minister is stating this country is accepting Indian criminals as prospective immigrants. What do you make of that comment?
Well, I think that that's really an inappropriate comment. I mean, there are people that come to this country when, people come and then they change. These students came. I don't know whether they came 3-4 years ago with the intention to kill somebody. And they happen to be Sikhs too. They're Indian citizens, but they're Sikhs. So is it, is it some internecine thing or is it some Indian agent pulling the strings from here or from India, or is it some gangster in India in jail that is pulling the strings of other gangsters? No one knows, but for the foreign minister of India to say that we willingly and knowingly accept criminals, I think that's a bit of a reach.
And, you know, when he went on to comment, he also said that Canada is his country's biggest problem and accuses all political parties of giving extremists legitimacy here in Canada under the guise of free speech. You know, it makes me wonder, as we kind of go through the commentary of the foreign minister, is there anything to pull out of that? Are political leaders dropping the ball when it comes to concerns being expressed by a traditionally friendly country?
Absolutely. On that score, I think he is 1,000% correct. Our politicians, for votes, you know, in close ridings or close contests, 1 or 2% make a difference. There is Khalistani vote, 5 to 10% of the Sikhs may be Khalistanis, and they will vote for the parties. They don't stop them. The fact is that they have taken shelter. The politicians have taken shelter, refuge under the rubric of freedom of expression for too long. They have seen violence happen from our country, Canada. They've seen violence, you know, AK-47s being paraded around in the posters in Surrey, in Brampton and other places, and they've said nothing. And, you know, they can go a bit further and say, you know, India is a friendly country. India is a democracy, faltering perhaps at this moment. We don't want Quebec to separate from us. Therefore, we don't want a dismemberment of a friendly country. We don't support what you're doing. You have the right to ask for that, but you have no right to perpetrate violence here or in India in the name of that, because we don't support a dismemberment of that country. Nobody has said that clearly. What they have said, both Mr. Harper and Mr. Trudeau, we have our system of laws, we have rule of law, and we have freedom of expression. We can't really tell people not to speak out. It is not the speaking out. It's the organizing. It is the disrupting. It's the sending money from here through Pakistan or directly to India. Mr. Nijjar was on their wanted list for several crimes that he committed after he had been in Canada. I don't know whether those are, you know, trumped up charges or real charges. But the fact is that India made several requests for him to be sent back to India, and our government ignored them, basically saying, you don't understand our laws. And, you know, that may be so. But I believe Canadian politicians are complicit in what the Khalistanis are doing in this country.
You know, let me unpack a bit about that, though, because as you say, there are different statements that politicians could be making around the situation of Khalistan. And for people who don't know, that is the movement within the Sikh community to create a Sikh homeland out of India. But, you know, I wonder, when you talk about political calculations, if they actually made that statement, how badly would it hurt a political party within the Sikh community, do you think?
Not badly at all. Look, I mean, you know, I fought these guys in the 80s. And despite their united opposition to me in British Columbia, I mean, all of the temples from all over British Columbia and some from outside of British Columbia, you know, Khalistani temples and Khalistani people, all of them opposed me. I still got nominated. I became the leader of the NDP despite their opposition. And despite their opposition, I was one of the most popular politicians, even though my party was the least popular party in British Columbia at that time. So you tell me about it.
So if you were to give advice, because at this point we have seen a deterioration in the relationship between Ottawa and New Delhi, if you were to give any advice to this government or any government to follow, what would it be as to how to handle this case? Or this
it
relationship?
You can't go back on how Mr. Trudeau handled it. But it would be to actually say, it's easy for a democracy to say about another democracy that we don't want dismemberment of friendly countries. We don't support it. We want to tell you that. And therefore, please don't disrupt the unity or integrity of that country. We don't support that. That's all they need to say. And if they ever said that, I guarantee you, India's mood, it's not just Mr. Modi. All politicians in India do not like what Canada is doing. Mr. Modi is perhaps more extreme than others in the way he views Canada or his foreign minister views Canada. But I was in India in May last year and October, some months ago. All politicians detest what Canadian politicians have allowed Khalistanis to do from this land, including Air India.
Mm-hmm. Now, the three men that were charged last week will be tried. The RCMP also made it known that other investigations are taking place right now. How concerned should Canada be about the impact that those investigations will have on relations with India?
If politicians do what I'm suggesting they do, then no matter what happens with the investigations, my sense would be that the Indian politicians would be saying, well, you know, this is a bit of a bump. Let's get over it. Let's cooperate with these individuals and with Canada and get over the bump. Because ultimately, it is in our interest as Indians and Canadians as countries to get along. I mean, you know, there aren't too many democracies in the world.
Ujjal Dasanjh, I always appreciate the insight. Thank you for this.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
Well, time now for a look at what else happened in politics today. The Prime Minister and Conservative Party leader joined members of the Jewish community this morning, speaking at a ceremony in Ottawa to mark Yom HaShoah, also known as Holocaust Remembrance Day. Yom HaShoah is an Israeli holiday observed by Jews around the world, and it commemorates the more than 6 million Jews killed in the Holocaust during the Second World War at the hands of the Nazis. In their remarks, Justin Trudeau and Pierre Poilievre condemned the rise in anti-Semitic incidents in Canada, especially in the aftermath of the October 7 attack.
That's why combating anti-Semitism requires hard work every day. And this work cannot be a problem for the Jewish community to solve alone. It is not a problem for Deborah or Jewish organizations to solve alone. It is not a problem for governments to solve alone, though we will and must continue to do everything we can. It is up to everyone to take on this challenge, all Canadians together.
I know that some of you are making the heart-wrenching decision. Do I walk outside with the Star of David on my chest? Do I wear my kippah? Do I keep my mezuzah on the door? You worry about the safety of your loved ones in Canada. It is absolutely unacceptable that you should be faced with this dilemma. You must be allowed to live fearlessly and proudly Jewish lives, and it is the responsibility of every Canadian, Jewish or otherwise, to stand with your right to do that.
The result of the aggressive rise in anti-Semitism is that Jews from coast to coast, after being subjected to dehumanizing levels of hate over the course of the previous year, have been left feeling ostracized and abandoned. The systemic nature of the anti-Semitism has forced Canadian Jews to question the continued vitality of the nation's Jewish communities.
Well, that was B'nai B'rith Canada, and today, on this Monday, they released their annual anti-Semitism audit. The report found a dramatic increase in anti-Semitic incidents year over year. There were more than 5,700 reported incidents of anti-Semitism in 2023, the highest on record, according to the report. That figure includes a number of violent attacks and reports of harassment against the Jewish community. B'nai B'rith representatives were joined by a group of MPs on the Hill this morning, raising awareness and calling on the government to do more to protect the Jewish community from hate.
5,791 anti-Semitic incidents up in just 1 year. That's nearly fivefold in 10 years. I don't know how to say this any other way, but it is a crisis in Canada. It is rampant in our streets, on our university campuses, and everywhere in between, in workplaces, online.
It's like forest fire that is running rampant across the country. Anti-Semitism is everywhere. It is in the workplace. It is in our communities. It is in our neighborhoods. It is in our places of worship. Certainly in my community, I've spoken with families virtually every day since October the 7th. And it is horrifying to hear the stories that they tell me. They're afraid to keep their mezuzahs on their door. They're afraid to send their children to school. They're afraid to display any aspect of their Jewish identity. And this is a gross injustice.
Well, the Conservative leader had a direct message for corporate Canada, telling them in a letter published in the National Post that their current efforts in Ottawa are pointless, that Ottawa does not listen to their lobbying efforts, and that members to the Council of Business Council of Alberta and the Canadian Federation of Independent Business should cancel their memberships and stop handing money over to those groups. Well, to talk about this, we're now joined by Dan Kelly. He is the president and the CEO of the Canadian Federation of Independent Business. Dan, good to see you. Thank you for joining us.
It'll be with you.
Listen, I'm going to start by pointing out, which may be the obvious, that Pierre Poilievre is making a bigger point here. But in making that point, he does use your organization as an example of, and forgive the terminology here, wasted effort that goes nowhere. Is the Conservative leader correct?
Well, certainly not with respect to my organization. I think he makes a couple of valuable points kind of later in his piece, but no, gosh, just in the most recent budget, there was a $2.5 billion rebate for small and medium-sized businesses from the carbon tax that had been stuck in Ottawa for 5 years. And I can tell you for certain, one of the only reasons this happened is because of the advocacy of the Canadian Federation of Independent Business, the organization I run.
So that is one concrete example. But, you know, are you worried about the impact that Poilievre's letter will actually have on your organization?
Well, look, it is a bit, it's interesting because he's suggesting our members in Alberta should drop their memberships in CFIB because I guess we're not conservative enough. But it is interesting because the premier of Alberta, Daniel Smith, was a former staff person, the head of our Alberta lobby group. So it is interesting.
Interesting, as you say, and it seems to go to an increasing polarization in the Canadian political environment. Does that worry you then about how effective you can be able to lobby and influence decisions being made in Ottawa?
Look, there's no question. There's some hyper partisanship that is going on right now. When you take a step back, I give Pierre great credit. He has said this to me privately dozens and dozens of times in the meetings that we've had with him over the years. Back probably a decade ago, he lectured me for a long, long time about the reasons why my organization should give up nonpartisanship as one of our founding principles and endorse the Conservative Party. He makes some arguments. Look, unions and social policy groups, they routinely will endorse a candidate, endorse a political party, fight on an election campaign for someone, and then they have to work with whomever's in power. So he is of the view that the Conservatives, they look around and, you know, lots of groups like mine suggest things that they should do, but we're not there to get them elected or to help defeat a particular government. But I got to tell you, we have a multi-party system. I think my organization would be far less effective and have zero credibility if it were to endorse a particular party or a particular candidate.
Mm-hmm. You know, party endorsement aside, the letter also seems to make this point that if you want to change minds, you and other groups need to do it at the grassroots level. Will that change the way you do your lobbying as a result of this letter?
Well, I think he makes there a really good and strong argument, but I will say that is the way that we have operated for 53 years from the very beginnings of this organization. I don't think any objective observer of my organization would suggest that we aren't out there on some really tricky, sometimes unattractive issues, screaming and yelling, like defending the use of the temporary foreign worker program or pushing back against huge minimum wage increases. There are some business associations and some individual businesses that do push the Conservatives to represent them on tough issues, but then they themselves hide in the background. I get that point, but that's not what we do at CFIB. I'm on the front lines every day, standing with ministers and politicians when they make good decisions, and fighting hard when they make bad ones, which is a big part of what I do.
Okay. And you know, but for the last 9 years or so, it has been a Liberal government. Poilievre and his party right now have been leading the polls for months. He says he will refuse to meet your group. He does so right now as the opposition leader. But how will you navigate a lack of access if he becomes prime minister?
Well, look, I'll tell you one interesting fact. We have advanced public policy on probably a dozen major files, like standing with Chrystia Freeland in, on a major reduction in credit card processing fees last year. I've not had a single meeting with one-on-one meeting with Prime Minister since Prime Minister Trudeau since he was in office. So there are ways of affecting public policy change without necessarily meeting the top person in charge. We do that through grassroots lobbying every day. We have every single Conservative MP that uses our data almost daily in the House of Commons. There's lots of strategies we can use. I do think, though, that would change taking office. Yeah, you may not want to meet with me, but or with other business association types. But the data that we provide, the insights that we provide, are invaluable to whomever is in office. And certainly have been for the current government. We fought with them on a dozen or so issues, but agreed on others and worked with them where we can.
You know, Dan, I'm listening to what you're saying here. I wonder, do you interpret this letter as a warning or as a political ploy?
A bit of both. Look, the main reason that this is as public as this is right now is he is trying to establish the point with Canadians that he is not the plaything of the business community, that he's not just going to carry water for corporations or for business groups. And I believe him. I think he's right. And I think that message that he's trying to make to the public is a correct and a valid one. I don't think it's a surprise. It's very political, but I think pretty honest. And so I accept that at face value. At the same time, to ignore major business associations, the data that they collect, the information and ideas they put forward, the country would be worse off. I'm not overly worried that that's going to end up being the net result if the government were to change. We're going to continue to operate in a nonpartisan fashion as we have for 53 years, and we'll work with whomever wishes to work with us and scream and yell in the sidelines if they don't.
Dan Kelly, always appreciate the time. Thank you for this.
Not at all.
And that is our program for this Monday evening. I'm Michael Serapio. For everyone here at CPAC, thank you for watching. Primetime Politics is back tomorrow night. Until then, take care.